America. Start listening now.
Start listening now.
Oh, a little bit late, but that's okay. That's all right. Hi, Danny. How was how's it going?
Hi. I guess coming in late. I mean it's the end of June. We've been taking it easy. Speaking of June, Eric, it being Pride Month, what's the gayest Eurovision you've ever been to?
Junior 2021. Roll it. And welcome to another gay episode of 12 Points from America, a Eurovision Song Contest podcast from America, home of the Runza. I'm Eric.
I'm Derek.
I'm Samantha.
And I'm Danny. We are the home of the Runza. And we're gay. Right.
Mm-hmm.
At least, one of us is at least out as...
Yeah.
The royal we,
the two things that I think people who listen to this the podcast are really going for, both the gays and Runzas.
We got them all, people. We got them all.
It's everything you wanted and more. Speaking of which, hey, finally, a segue that'll work for once. Sam, hit him with those socials.
Yeah, and you can find us on all the standard and substandard social media outlets at 12pointsUSA, or just email us directly at 12pointsfromamerica@gmail.com. You can find some of our merchandise over on our Redbubble page. You can also support us via a monthly contribution on Patreon or a one-off contribution on our Ko-fi account. That's Ko-fi. And whether you support us financially or not, we love you and appreciate you and see you either way. But Patreon supporters get exclusive content and early access to episodes. But on our general social media, you could follow us for silly stuff like what Eric just posted this week, for example. Favorite Eurovision optometry puns?
That's right, Sam.
Yeah.
It was about
six. Is this based off the fact that basically everywhere that you go in Europe, there is something called Eurovision? Like,
no, it's not. It's not that at all, actually. I was going through, you know, your Facebook memories where you can look at how much worse your life used to be or whatever. About 6 years ago, I found I was in New York City. I was on a walk by myself. I was basically just walking up like Broadway from the Flatiron Building, where I had eaten at my second eatery of the weekend. I was, just walking, listening to music, having a nice time. And I walked past an optometry shop on like 40th and Broadway, something like that, called Eurovision Optical. I did about a triple take because it seemed like something I would make up. It's not. It's real. It's still open, according to Google. You can go there if you're in New York. If you
nice.
Want
eyes like a sued yet. Yeah,
eyes like a phoenix, as it were. I asked our wonderful, wonderful Twitter followers, what are your? Let's fire up the pun gun. What are your best Eurovision eye puns? And we had some good ones. Shout out to Dude Points, who said "Look Telk." That's obviously pretty good.
Yes.
Yeah.
There too.
Optometristy Karma from Ital Eye in 2017.
Jesus.
That one's, that's, yeah. I see the scars in your eyes from Bambi Thug. I liked,
I was a big fan of Bistrai Voda by Retina. I thought that was a really well done one on both levels. That was pretty genius. Shout out to Artikazen for that one.
I enjoy this. Is from Lisa Rent a Good Book said, not technically a pun, but scared of heights because of no depth perception. That's fine. Yeah, we've got we had a lot of good ones. Check us out on X, the app that's everyone still calls Twitter because X is stupid. Did I tell you guys I saw a Cybertruck in real life?
Ew.
Yeah, there was one in my parking lot.
They're out there.
Listeners, I'm sorry if you have one of these or like one. That is the dumbest looking thing in the universe. I can't believe it.
It takes a lot to top the uglitude of like the Pontiac Aztec circa 2001.
Yep. Yep. No, this
but
is
that
way
does
worse.
It. That's just a doorstop with wheels, isn't it?
This is like we had to render a car in Super Mario 64 and only had like 12 polygons to work with. I'm so, like, I'm sorry. If you think this thing is cool, you're wrong. It's ridiculous. It's, I could not believe it when I saw it. Anyway, I saw a Cybertruck. Let us know more of your best Cybertruck Eurovision puns or Eurovision eye puns or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I think Jenna, one of our followers on the socials, basically just put a pretty big button on it, just saying we literally had a group called Who See at the contest. So, I mean,
it's true.
Sometimes the
low-hanging fruit. Curacao. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. Oculare. Oh, oh. Mm-hmm. All right. We don't have a ton of news at the moment. We're probably still at least a month and a half, 2 months out before we know what host city we're going to. So, you know, kick that can down the road for another couple of episodes from now. We mentioned in our last episode that a petition was levied towards the Latvian parliament asking for the funds that go to Eurovision to be rerouted to sports instead. That has been turned down by the Saeima, by the Latvian parliament. So I guess it's not an ongoing question. I don't know whether we can consider that a confirmation that Latvia will be in Switzerland next year, but I take that as a pretty good sign.
Sure hope so.
Yeah.
Look, when your parliament basically says, no, we're going, I think it's good.
Yeah. Over at Junior Eurovision, which we know is going to be in Madrid this November, we have the sad news that the United Kingdom has declined to participate at Junior this year, which is really sad. They'd come off of two really solid performances coming in, what, fifth and fourth? Just really good songs. But evidently they weren't getting the ratings that they were hoping for.
Is it about the ratings?
Yeah. I'm assuming so. Yeah. I'm assuming so. Just return on investment. I've heard reports that both the Scottish and Welsh broadcasters have also declined. So it's not like either of them are picking up the mantle like they're technically able to in the absence of a pan-British broadcaster or a pan-UK broadcaster, I should say. Because I don't know if, you know, BBC Northern Ireland has a following to do that, but
I thought you were going to say, it's because I don't know if the BBC is pan.
Which brings us to our topic.
Yeah, man. It's, speaking of things that
I'm the master of the segues tonight. It's going to be good.
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah. Before we officially go in there back on Junior, just wanted to say Germany has released the snippets for their potential Junior Eurovision entries. They're cute. They're German. One of the songs, however, was co-written by Taya, as in Taya and Selena Taya. So keep your eyes open for that.
Can't be stopped.
It's no, it's called Who the Hell is Barney?
Writing in German.
Who the Hell is Bluey?
Yeah. Who the Hell is Bluey? There you go.
Who the Hell is Bluey?
Yeah. This is how old I am. My references are terrible.
You know, my brain was trying to figure out how to say who the hell is Tinky Winky in German, and it wasn't working. But
you know what one of the other Teletubby names is?
Po, 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 no, po, po.
There
po,
you
po.
Go.
Oh, no, you got it. Mm-hmm.
Was Tinky
Derek,
Winky
we can
the gay
see
one?
In your eyes, buddy.
Yeah.
Which one was the gay one?
Tinky Winky.
Okay. So, all right. So, speaking
the
of
the purple one with the triangle in the purse. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, speaking of gay European things, Eurovision. We're going to talk about, we're going to celebrate Pride a little bit here. Talk about some of the history of LGBT presence at the contest. Obviously, now we know this as a thing that is quite gay, as they say. But how did we get to that point, I guess, is what we're hoping to figure out today.
How did we get to gay?
Yes. How is gay
they
formed?
They stole the rainbow from God. Then they took Eurovision.
And still, I said nothing.
Happy Pride, everybody.
This is going great. This is going to go fantastic. All right. Where do we want to start?
I think we can kind of talk about this in sort of overreaching. And I think we're all kind of coming from this that, you know, three out of the four of us consider themselves at least heterosexual. I don't know enough of you to buy.
Danny, as our gay, why don't you...
as our gay, yeah.
Yeah, I want to make sure that you have...
Finally, my time to shine.
Yes, you've been hiding. I've been useless up to this point.
As our ambassador to the other end of the Kinsey scale. If we could start anywhere, I personally would like to start, and maybe Sam would be the expert on this. When did it start to veer into this field? Like when did people start acknowledging, at least, that this was a demographic that was really into Eurovision?
I mean, that's a really huge question. And I'm sure that like PhDs have been done about this kind of thing. But I think it kind of goes into what makes Eurovision. It wasn't me who put this comment in our shared notes, but the aesthetic of camp. And how did that, when did that start really appearing at Eurovision? Was it, you know, with the rise of really like the staging aspect of it, rather than just being a song contest, being a performance contest? When did it go from a music festival to a festival that is camp and spectacular and traditionally / stereotypically seen as gay?
Yeah. I feel like it was camp from the beginning. there's something to be said. So when we look at, I'm about to put on my liberal arts major hat here and be like, well, in Susan Sontag's Notes on Camp, but there is an idea in Notes on Camp about the idea of the instant persona, like the persona that is created just spur of the moment and is complete artifice. And I feel like that is, when you watch the old Eurovision and you have someone not just come on stage and sing a song, but like give music to a orchestra and the conductor is just playing this song. And it's like, it's deliberately like appealing to a kind of middle class aesthetic, like a middle class taste. Like the concert itself is so middle brow. Like it's so trying to be palatable to everyone. And that is sort of where camp thrives the most. Like, this idea of like this pretentiousness is so prime for being made fun of. So I feel like at the beginning there was the one aspect of camp, which is like making fun of the content, watching it because it is so unbelievably bourgeois, because it is so postured and so. So serious, so dour in its seriousness or its desire to be taken seriously.
People and then there's the idea that as time goes on, conductors, you know, holding their batons and
When we were talking about when we were watching the 1989 contest, how everyone in the audience either is wearing like a full black tuxedo or looks like she's a waitress at a supper club. That's what we're talking about. Like it is so trying to be serious and like, oh, we're here for, well, we are here for muy culture, moltissimo, you know. So there's something to be said about the internationality of the contest too, which has a certain type of aspiration to importance.
Yeah. If I may interject slightly, while I was looking into this, I came across an article that I think maybe gives us an answer to a question we had in our last episode, which was, when did Eurovision stop doing that thing where the audience was like,
oh yeah,
tuxedo people and mm-hmm. monocles and very shallow and pedantic, that sort of thing. Like, this article, which is primarily though about when did the gay thing happen, so to speak. And there's, I think the answer to this may be the same for both of those questions. And it notes that in 1998, so mm-hmm. this was the contest in Birmingham after mm-hmm. Katrina and after the Waves.
Love Shine a Light, yeah.
This was also the year after the first openly gay contestant. That was in 97.
Yep.
That was Paul Oscar from Iceland. Nice Icelandic name there. Paul Oscar.
I mean, he's Paul Oscar Hjelmithison or something.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, but yeah, Paul Oscar. Yeah.
Yes. The organizers in Birmingham in 98 basically decided to put the audience right next to the stage. and put them more in front of cameras, basically. And this article notes, this is said by Brian Singleton, the Samuel Beckett Chair of Drama Theater at Trinity College Dublin, is quoted in this. So you know,
yes,
you know that it's extremely legit. This guy wrote the Book of Kells.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's how that works. But noted that when they did that, it became immediately obvious that the audience was predominantly composed of gay men. So if you go back, you watch 1998, you'll see that there was a, as he says, it really sent a signal across Europe that was the case. But it was building to that, I think, before then. There were viewing parties going on. There were fan clubs in like the 80s that had really strong ties to the LGBT community of the time. And it just kind of grew from there. That's the conclusion that this particular article says.
For sure. So I think that we just had the ripe environment for it being like, for the gays to finally swallow up this contest, to finally conquer this contest. But the very nature of it being an art contest sort of lends itself to be so susceptible to the camp sensibility. Because when you're trying to win, like, the tendency to be so over the top and be extravagant to get people's attention, it's there. So it's naturally going to happen every time that you're going to have these acts that are absolutely ridiculous and almost laughable with how serious they are, how really going for it and how pumping the gas they are.
And by the way, let us not forget who won the contest in 1998.
Of course. Donna International. Yeah.
Yeah. Big, mm-hmm. So big year for the gays in 98, I think is where we're there. I was also curious about, cause this is just something I didn't know, going back even further and just thinking about LGBT culture in general in Europe in the 20th century, if Europe had its equivalent of like Stonewall or something like that. And the answer appears to be no. In fact, their Stonewall might just be Stonewall. That was more of a international effect eventually.
Only they call it something, you know, with an accent like Le Stonewall. Pared de piedra.
Yeah, yeah. The wall of stone is what it's got to be. I did learn something else that I absolutely have to share with you guys because it's insane. Just looking at the history of gay rights in various points in Europe, and it varies a lot. Obviously, like over the last 25 years or so, things have certainly improved. The Netherlands was the first country to legalize civil marriage for gay couples. Denmark had some legal distinctions before that, but didn't use the word marriage, and there are a few dozen countries that do it now. But before that, in 1979, in Sweden, where homosexuality had been, and as was fairly common at the time, I think, been classified as an illness, There was a wave of protest in Sweden in which people would call in sick to work with a bad case of being gay. And this went on for several months before the National Board of Health and Welfare in Sweden just changed that classification. And I think that is one of the best forms of protest I've ever heard. Just call and be like, listen, I can't make the burgers at Max today. I'm just too gay.
I love a little bit of malicious compliance. I love it when you just take the rules and bend them towards the arc of justice. It's kind of, you know,
I'm going to be out for at least 10 days with homonucleosis.
It's tough. It's contagious too. I don't want to, you know. Anyway,
I think it should also maybe be mentioned that Eurovision at its heart, you know, we know that it's meant to be a technological, you know, exchange between broadcasters, but at its heart, people who are watching this, it's meant to be an environment where all are welcome, where you are crossing boundaries, crossing cultures. You're seeing people of different languages, different backgrounds, different faiths. Why not different? Like, everybody is welcome. And especially when you bring in the theatricality of it, I think that just, if you're watching, if you are, you know, a kid who is not feeling welcome in certain places, you turn on Eurovision seeing a place where everybody is welcome. That might mean a lot to people. And I mean, granted, I can't speak from the point of view of having, you know, I'm fully realizing I'm coming into this as a cisgender heterosexual person. Like, I understand that. But
from a perspective of somebody who was uncool, maybe, or weird or different, not necessarily gay, but like talking about, if it has this all inclusive, if you're an outsider of some degree, there's definitely an appeal there. And I'm sure for many years that was more extreme than it is now.
Certainly. Yeah, this is a contest that by its nature welcomes all. At least it should. At least it should. And if you look back at the history of the contest, whether it was explicitly, you know, a welcoming gay event or just implicitly, this has been, you know, there have been gay performers or performers who have been all over the LGBTQIA plus community since literally the first contest. They've been more visible in the last, you know, 30 years. However, they've been there since the very, very beginning. One of the earliest winners. We look back on it now and we're realizing, oh yeah, that was really gay, y'all.
Look, we did that for a lot of things in the 50s too.
We did. But I think, and you know, mentioning the artist in the first contest, Danny Dauberson singing for France, was a lesbian. In 1959 and 61, the Belgian act, who was the same person, was also gay. But in 1961, the winner from Luxembourg, Jean-Claude Pascal, who didn't come out publicly during his lifetime, but we know now, you know, his loved ones have come out, and I feel slightly icky about saying outed him post, you know, after his passing, but I don't, it's not my story to tell. But we look at the lyrics now, and I'm bringing up the lyrics for the song, the winning song from 1961, Nous les Amoureux, We the Lovers. And let me just read you a segment of the lyrics here.
Do it in French.
We the lovers, they want to separate us. They would like to prevent us from being happy. We the lovers, it seems like it's hell that watches us, or else the iron and the fire. It's true, the idiots and the evil ones harm us, do bad things to us. However, nothing more is more obvious than love. We the lovers can do nothing against them. They are 1,000 and we are 2, the lovers. But the hour is going to ring on the least difficult nights, and I could love you without them talking about it downtown. It's promised, it's written down. We the lovers, the sun shines for us, and we sleep on the knees of the good Lord. We the lovers, he gave us the right to be happy and be joyful together. Then the without loves, the misloved, it will be necessary that we pay back those who have never been condemned. We, the lovers, we're going to live without you, for the sky is with us, the lovers. I want to hear that at a pride parade. Like somebody like that, it's beautiful. And it's been there since early on in the contest.
That sort of act of like, of when you're singing love songs and always saying you and and sometimes us, is there is a bit of history to that. I'm reminded, this is much later than New Les Amoureux, but I watched a mini documentary about the punk band the Buzzcocks, and this is, I don't know, Sam, is there a Buzzcocks connection to Eurovision? Let's hear it.
Oh God!
God, not that I can think of. God,
for once,
For who the once. Hell knows? Who okay. the hell knows?
Fair enough. But
finally, the Buzzcocks are safe from Eurovision.
Fair enough. For now.
Well, Pete Shelley.
Maybe one of them had a beer with Johnny Lydon or had a punch up with him at some point. Who knows?
Yeah, quite possibly. But there, Pete Shelley, the front man of the Buzzcocks, who sadly passed away a few years ago, when he wrote songs, he made a point to write. So, like the song "Ever Fallen in Love," that you hopefully know if you're listening or are on this podcast. That's directed at you. You spurred my natural emotions and so on. He never says she, never says he, because he wanted to let the listener fill those things in. I don't know where I'm going with this, I guess, but I'm reminded of that and how that sort of choice of language has perhaps been a thing.
Yeah, whether it's for the benefit of the listener, you being able to paint in your own story, or for the benefit of the singer and songwriter to be able to tell their story honestly without outing themselves. I mean, and in some languages it's a lot easier than in others. I mean, French mm-hmm. is a gendered language. Like every, you know, English, not as much. You could say you, but you know, other languages may have masculine you and feminine you.
Yeah.
Doesn't even enter into the non-binary aspect of things.
Yeah. It's really tough when you're singing about like your washing machine and you end up like singing to a woman. Yeah.
This, we still see this today, that to avoid the political trappings of certain topics or themes, that they use certain vagaries to get around it. And, you know, sexuality being a huge one, especially at a time when it was difficult. And you can retrospectively look back and see, oh, this was very clearly a gay allegory or a gay story that they very surreptitiously disguised as kind of just a general love song that anybody could be plugged into.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's like the second Nightmare on Elm Street.
Okay, can I say, I just watched that a couple months ago, and I was shocked. Shocked. I know people hate it, but movie podcast. Shocked that movie is so extremely obviously about like AIDS fears and like worries about like catching the gay. It's so obvious. It's so obvious. It's insane. I can't believe the director was just like, oh, we had no idea. We had no idea that, like, I don't know, getting your naked butt whipped in a locker room was gay. We had no idea. I love it. But I have something to add here, which is that there's a universality to sort of when you're, I don't know, if you're trying to mask the fact that you're singing about the struggles of, you know, being a star-crossed lover for any reason. It's universal. There is a universality to suffering for love that anyone can latch onto. That's something that anyone can understand in a moment's notice. There's this, I'm only going to bring him up once because he's the devil to certain gays. But Andrew Sullivan has this essay that he wrote in the 90s. Andrew Sullivan's a, you know, kind of a stain, but unfortunately he's a stain with a brain. He said something about how this essay is called "What Are Homosexuals For?" Which is an incendiary title. But he talks about sort of like the purpose that society has pigeonholed sort of like gays who decide to be open with being gay, like where they are typically shunted to in society. It talks about caregiver roles and having artistic sensibilities. And he has a couple of 90s political sensibilities that he expresses in this essay that I do not agree with. But he says something about how the way that gays have to sort of mature while denying their true self for a period that is longer for some people or shorter than some people leads to an ability to, and I think I'm getting this phrase exactly right, the aestheticization of pain, that sort of every gay person ends up being able to develop an almost artistic sensibility for pain. And I think that Andrew is talking from a place of privilege when he describes this, but I think the words he uses are, again, incendiary. But I have to agree that there is a germ of truth in there that there is, like, I don't know, this ability to alchemize the pain that you've gone through in any way into a creative endeavor. I end up thinking that this is something that is actually universal to any artist, but I think it's particularly true of Eurovision, which has attracted such a camp following and has attracted so many gay aspirants to winning the contest, that I think it's at least something apt to bring up, that if you're going to, you know, come to the contest with this sensibility of over the topness or this instant persona of deadly seriousness, there's a mingling of things. There's a co-mingling of so many strange sensibilities that Andrew Sullivan would argue comes naturally to the gays, but I think the culture of growing up gay sort of gets you very, very in touch with what is camp, what is exaggerated, what is high aesthetic, that I think a lot of people can just glean by being on Twitter for 10 years and letting their brains atrophy. But I think it all works. Amen here. I think that there's a sort of universality to this pain that is brought to, that is sort of part and parcel to a lot of the songs that come to Eurovision.
Wow.
Wow.
I don't have a joke.
Sam, roll the credits music.
I mean, this. I think we always kind of have that image of the tortured artist.
Yeah, always.
People. Oh, yeah.
And, you know, you see a lot of, not to be insensitive, a lot of really great art come out of communities that have suffered.
Yeah, always.
And even when I think about, I remember
Notes
Sam
on Camp
having...
talks about not just about gays, but about how it is unfortunate but true that the crimes done to Jewish people has spawned a lot of great art. She puts it way more artfully than that, but she says there's a connection between this idea of suffering and being able to alchemize that into art again.
Yeah, it's a universal thing. Like, yep. Happiness and comfort doesn't necessarily, you know,
yeah, make good art.
Nice.
Yeah.
Contentment is nice. Don't get me wrong. Everybody wants to be happy. Everybody deserves comfort and happiness. But, you know, music and art and expression often comes from places of pain and hurt and trauma. And that's partially a means of therapy and partially a means of finding community. So it's, yeah, I understand that. It's, I never really thought about it that way, but I see what you mean.
I mean, kind of steering it back to the topic at hand. It's,
oh, we have a topic.
I know. It's interesting to see that the necessity to kind of hide what you're really trying to say makes it more universal. And And I wonder how many people listen to these songs that were deliberately vague to avoid, you know, coming out or any kind of backlash, and ends up like really touching people who otherwise wouldn't connect. Like, like even listen to the French song "Us the Lovers." Like, wow, that was really moving.
Yeah.
And even though I can still put myself in that situation and imagine me being with someone who would be looked down on or ostracized. For any number of reasons, really.
You know, thinking about it also kind of explains how the folks that take issue with these sorts of topics tend to come from points of extreme privilege.
That, oh, like Piers Morgan?
Well, okay. But like...
I'm sorry, when I searched, I did a YouTube search on when did Eurovision get gay, and like the second video recommendation was Piers Morgan trash talking Eurovision, and I had to watch it. It was beautiful. If there's any poster child for the person that the contest is not for, it's Piers Morgan.
I'm just saying I feel like there's a certain level of privilege that makes, or beyond which these things stop becoming relatable.
Mm-hmm.
And there. Also, really quick, breaking news. I gotta look. This isn't like Ali Alexander breaking news. It's not like that.
Okay.
I just need to know. I need to read you some lyrics that I found while we were talking about this. This is from a song called "Friends" by the Buzzcocks, written by Pete Shelley, the guy we were talking about, the guy I was talking about. This is from a 2003 album. So after their heyday, but this is the first verse of a song called Friends. Well, I've been up all night, couldn't get to dream at all, trying hard not to make a decision. You know, it doesn't seem right when your back's to the wall to be accused of sensationalism, but the way things are going, wouldn't be at all surprised if a song that I liked won the next Eurovision.
Well done.
Rest in peace, Pete Shelley. He was open. I don't think I said this before. Pete was openly bisexual, which was, especially like in the punk community, which was he was a part of, was a little unusual. But yeah, so Eurovision podcast. We found the connection. I found it before Sam did. I feel
yeah, because I wasn't looking for it. I was trying to have a conversation. But you no, you beat me to it. I give you props for that.
Yes. So
who can we actually say is our first LGBTQ plus open contestant at the contest?
That would be, as we mentioned, Paul Oscar from Iceland in 1997. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just wanted to.
And then was it just like a steady trickle every now and then?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, there were three in 1990. I mean, I don't know how many were open in 97. Mm-hmm. According from what I can see, it may have just been one lead artist, Paul, one artist who was part of an ensemble. And I believe Katrina of the Waves came out after the fact.
Yes, she was not
Paul Oscar. But Paul Oscar is generally considered to be the first out Eurovision act. His song Min Hinsti Dans unfortunately came in 20th place that year. I think if the song honestly, that was the year that some countries were just beginning to test out public voting instead of a pure jury vote. Yeah. If it had been a different ratio, he would have done a lot better. The countries that were experimenting with public voting that year.
Yeah. Rated Remind him pretty us easily. when sort of like public vote became like the majority rule. That's early 2000s, right?
Yeah, so in 1998, participating countries were required to use televoting, mm-hmm. Unless the you know telephone network was unstable enough that they would have had to have a backup. But no, it was 98 was the first year that it was really, really pushed. 97 was just beginning to trickle in. Just to kind of put this into the context for our American listeners, so 1997's contest was held on May 3rd, 1997. Just keep that in mind, May 3rd. A few days before, April 30th, 1997, that was when the puppy episode of Ellen.
Whoa. Aired.
That is the episode where Ellen came out.
Oh.
Which I think for an American audience was probably one of the first times that it was really something very, very public, very visible, that a well-known TV star, at least the character, and then we now, you know, Ellen came out, I think, just right around that time, the person, the actress, not just the character. But I think that was really the first time that a lot of people were really seeing a gay lead in American pop culture. Mm-hmm.
And having it be generally accepted.
There was pushback. Well, don't get me wrong, but it was, but yeah, but this
not
was
completely,
this...
but more than usual.
Yeah. You know. So just kind of putting that into the mix of like, where was, I mean, many of our listeners are too young to remember this. I know that I was 12 when Ellen came out. And I remember the kerfuffle around it. And part of me wonders, Iceland coming out, not a big deal. And especially in a smaller nation like Iceland, Paul Oscar probably knew half the island anyway, just, you know, it's a small country, you know, everybody. But how many places wouldn't have been as amenable to an out performer in a highly sexualized performance like Min Hinsti Dans was?
Yeah.
So I give Paul a massive amount of credit for that. And we had an act with a now out lesbian lead singer. The following year, our first trans act.
Who just
and won the whole
won.
Thing.
Yeah.
We didn't have any acts who were out or have come out since in 1999 or 2000. But it seems like every year since then, there has been at least one act who has been somewhere in the LGBTQIA plus spectrum family. And it seems that numerically 2024 was the most representative year yet. According to who is currently out now, the acts from Australia, Belgium, Czechia, Denmark, Ireland, Lithuania, some of the members from San Marino, Switzerland, and the United Kingdom identify somewhere within the rainbow flag. It's very, very cool to see. And including for the first time, non-binary acts, which we'd never had before this year.
Mm-hmm. We had three of them.
We had three.
Super cool.
Which is amazing.
You know what? I think, Danny, I got to take it back. Malmö was the gayest Eurovision I've been to.
It was statistically.
Statistically, it was the gayest Eurovision of them all.
Yeah.
Well,
gay.
We won it. We won it for the gays. You know what? Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's, where do we think we go from here? I think we've reached a point gayer. Now.
Even gayer.
I think we've reached a point where, you know, oftentimes, I mean, it's not even really a part of the conversation anymore. It's like, ooh, this act is gay. You know, they come out or it, mm-hmm. half the time, nobody gives a crap anymore.
Well, I was going to say nobody gives a crap anymore, but that is, and I don't mean to paint these countries as a monolith, but that is without Hungary and Belarus and Russia, you know, 1,000%. no longer regularly at the contest and being sort of notoriously unfriendly towards these people.
That is true. This is very much a Western mm-hmm. Europe.
We can say that, but it's, you know, when Kazakhstan's in the contest, perhaps we won't be singing the same song.
True. And I suppose, like, just to say that people aren't, you know, caring that these acts are gay or non-binary or lesbian, whatever you want to. That doesn't mean that's not important.
Yeah.
The visibility, especially in the winning song this year, The Code, which mm-hmm. was all about Nemo's journey to identify who they are as a non-binary person.
Not
that
subtle.
Is so important. And it was cared about, but it's not, you know, if we had press conferences this year, it's not like every question would be about, so you're non-binary, what's up with that?
It's, oh my it's God, not, can you imagine 20 it's, years ago it would have been though, you know?
It would have been. It absolutely like would have been.
Yeah.
And I'm thrilled to see that it's, you know, it's not the highlighted thing anymore. It's, you know, a part of the landscape. Sure. It's who, you know, who you are. And this, you know, the fact that I'm left-handed and politically liberal and it's just a part. Oh. Yeah. It's a part of who you are, but it doesn't mm-hmm. have to be the front and center.
I wonder how that aspect of the song and of Nemo is going to be incorporated into next year's contest. If there's a, I mean, I was going to say, do you work into the motto, but we already know it's United by Music, an increasingly inaccurate phrase, I think. Do they incorporate those, you know, some of those lyrical elements of that song into some of the messaging of the show?
Oh, yes. Switzerland. For 500 years, we've been neutral on everything.
Mm-hmm.
Just Ammonites everywhere. Yeah. Well, they kind of did that in Portugal, though. Somewhere between the O's and ones, I guess. You know, there's certainly some imagery that can be played around with that in terms of visual branding.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Breaking away from
binary. There's no reason to shy away from it anymore. That's for sure. Like,
yeah.
Now, yeah. What's the point?
Yeah, be who you are and bring the best and most honest version of yourself to the contest. People will respond to it, generally positively. And if you don't, then screw you.
Yeah. Well,
you know, Sam, I'm going to say that's one of the, that might be the perfect place to end.
I had one other quick one.
Yes, go for it.
Yeah.
I'll allow it.
Thank you. In terms of people who don't like it, I want to say there's, yeah, no, I know. I think it was Hungary. I don't know if it was Orban or like a cultural minister underneath Viktor Orban or something like that. But I want to say at some point they more or less explicitly said
Oh, yeah. Who was this? This is ringing a bell. Who was this? Yeah.
I think it was, it may have been after,
was it after Turkey was considering coming back in and then Conchita won? They were like, hell no.
I'm thinking of something more recent where like Hungary backed out. And one of the things they said was that they didn't approve of, and they didn't use these exact words, but they didn't approve of how gay the whole thing had become. Basically,
yeah, this is ringing bells from back in culturally, 2020 when they backed out, and there was the whole kerfuffle about everything gay in the schools and in like Hungarian society. I think this was all part of that.
Again, I come back to everybody should be welcome at Eurovision. Everybody with their head on straight will welcome you to Eurovision. Be the best version of yourself, the most honest version of yourself, whatever flavor you are.
Mm-hmm.
And you can hold your head proud, you know?
Yeah. Just looking at the Wikipedia page for Hungary in Eurovision, that there was no official reason for their withdrawal, but it was definitely during a big anti-LGBTQ rise in that country. An inside source speaking with index.hu, you know, those reputable folks, speculated that the contest was just considered too gay for MTVA to be a part of it. So there is at least one case, I guess, of a country of there being tangible rejection of this direction, which is unfortunate. But
I mean, honestly, political regimes come and go, political stances shift and change. Hopefully, away from perspectives like that. I look forward to what the future has to bring and the incredible artists that should feel welcome at the contest, whatever the future will bring.
Mm-hmm.
Happy Pride, everybody.
Yeah.
Love, Danny, and three straight people.
They get a pass.
Yay.
Hooray.
Hooray. Again, everybody, thank you so much for listening. Let us know what you thought. You can find us on all the standard social media outlets, 12 Points USA. Email us directly at 12pointsfromamerica@gmail.com. I will probably not be present for the next episode due to scheduling conflicts, but I will leave you in the very capable hands of the three men who I get to share this with. So, boys.
Dudes rock. Let's go.
Take care of the podcast. Yeah. I left a series of notes on the countertop of what you should take care of while I'm gone.
Yes, guys, we built the podcast. We got to glue it back together before mom gets home.
Guys.
And remember, no parties.
Oh, yeah, we'll see about that.
Well, I'll see you guys in two episodes, but until then, everybody, I've been Samantha.
I've been straight.
I've been Eric.
I've been Danny.
And America.
Stop listening
now.
Now. Does this mean you're no longer straight?